the Direction Democracy podcast from the University of Delaware Center for Political Communication. This podcast is part of the Center for Political Communication's National Agenda Series, Direction Democracy, which examines where we've been, where we're going, and the current state of democracy in the United States. I'm your host, Tom Byrne, News Director at Delaware Public Media. On this episode, we're joined, as always, by the UD Center for Political Communications Associate Director and National Agenda Series Director, Dr. Lindsay Hoffman. Lindsay, thanks for being with us again.
Sure. Hi.
And we're also happy to have with us Dr. Joanne Miller, Associate Professor in UD's Department of Political Science and International Relations. Her specialties include political psychology, political propaganda, misinformation, and conspiracy theories. Perfect time to have you here. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
A reminder that this podcast is being recorded shortly after 11 a.m. on Thursday, October 24th, and we realize that things could have changed between this moment and the time you are listening, especially in this political climate. Having said that, let's start with the story that dominates the political headlines, the House impeachment inquiry into President Trump, his handling of aid to Ukraine. Lindsay, we'll start with you. There's been this kind of constant drumbeat of stories, and with them, it seems, a slow increase in support, not only for the impeachment inquiry, but also even removing the president. Does it feel like we're going to kind of keep moving this way? And if this public opinion kind of keeps moving in that direction, could the Senate be swayed? Because the kind of the presupposition is like, yeah, they'll impeach him, but you know he's going to get acquitted in the Senate anyway.
Right. I think that's the key distinction. And my students were actually asking me yesterday, like, what do you think is going to happen, and how does this relate to, you know, the Clinton impeachment? And I said the major difference is public opinion. He had public opinion on his side. People were like, okay, yeah, do you be you, dude. Like, it was a very different circumstance, and it was more personal than political. So that's the key distinction here, is that we have the same scenario, but public opinion has swayed dramatically. So, I mean, just since September, middle of September, up to yesterday, according to 538, Nate Silver's great polling website, aggregation of polls shows that we are now 49.1% support impeachment and or removal from office, 43.5% don't support. And while, of course, Democrats are a large majority of that, 83% of Democrats are saying that impeachment should happen, the biggest increase has really been among independents. Mm-hmm. So they were at about 33% that mid-September. They are now up to almost 48%. So that's a huge jump among a key demographic of people.
And my question here is how important is that public opinion with the Senate? Because I think you hear a lot of senators kind of holding on to the same defense that they used for Bill Clinton, which is like, yeah, we're not comfortable with this, but it doesn't rise to impeachment. And in the case of Bill Clinton, public opinion seemed to follow that thinking, but now we seem to be a disconnect. I guess the question is, is there a tipping point here where that defense of it's not great, but it's not impeachable, It tips in the other direction?
Well, it seems to be that, I mean, just as of today, we have more officials coming out and kind of spilling the beans about what's happening. So I think that we have reached a tipping point, and I think that, you know, where there's smoke, there's fire. And if as we did today, that Ukraine did know about the quid pro quo, that was kind of the one thing that a lot of Republicans were saying, well, Ukraine didn't know about it. And now they say, yeah, we knew.
We knew what was going on.
We knew it was, we got it. we know what favor means. But that seemed to be the sticking point for a lot of Republican strategists, just as of yesterday that I was hearing on talk radio. And so that the question becomes, do they develop a new argument,
right,
or do they kind of concede, like, yeah, this is the beginning of the end? I don't know.
And Joanne, I want to bring you in here because at the heart of this Ukraine story are some of these conspiracy theories that you do take a look at, and that is obviously your expertise. Certainly there's this debunked piece about Ukraine having a democratic server that would exonerate Russia of 2016 election interference,
sure,
and somehow reveal criminal behavior by Hillary Clinton or Joe Biden or somebody. And also, to some extent, this connection to former Vice President Biden, his action regarding his son Hunter,
sure,
and his actions and Hunter's actions while on the board of a Ukrainian energy company. I don't expect you to dissect all of that. What sure. I do want to know is, like, you know, why do stories like this seem to take hold, even after they are kind of thoroughly debunked or there's no indication of any wrongdoing? And not only do they take hold, but it seems like certainly folks like President Trump can actually kind of turn them into weapons.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there's a lot to unpack here. I'll start with What my research and some of the other research suggests or is pretty strongly indicates why people believe conspiracy theories. One of the things that we know is that during times of uncertainty, when a big negative event happens and people are anxious and unsure about what's going on, one of the ways they can decrease uncertainty, oddly enough, is to believe in a conspiracy theory about the event. It's a way to sort of tie all this stuff into a neat conspiratorial bow. And people can sort of say, okay, that happened because bad people did something bad, and now I understand why it happened. We also know that people who feel powerless also are more likely to believe conspiracy theories. And believing conspiracies also helps you to bolster your own worldview or protect your own worldview. My side is losing not because we've got bad ideas, but because the other side are cheaters. So if you put all those three things together, one of the things that we see over time is that people on the losing side of politics are more likely to believe conspiracy theories than people on the winning side. So now the question is, why is Trump peddling in conspiracy theories as the winner, as the president? And why does it seem these days that Republicans are more apt to believe them? And my argument here is that one of the things that we've seen since the very first day Trump took office is that he kind of governs as a loser, in the sense of everyone's out to get me, the fake news media, everyone's out to get us. They don't want us to succeed. And today, or these days, with impeachment looming, public support, as Lindsay said, increasing for impeachment, there's this sort of, I think, panic in the Trump administration, or for Trump and his supporters, that we may now beginning to be losing. And again, taking hold of these conspiracies and believing these are the reasons that these things are happening, not because my guy Trump lied or cheated, but because others are out to get him.
And to a certain extent, I guess you could argue that because of the midterm elections, where there was a lot of Republican losing, that would kind of maybe spur or fuel this type of feeling like, okay, we don't want that to happen again in 2020, so we got to do something now.
But it is interesting that you mentioned that he kind of started governing that way,
right,
even as a winner. Is it kind of a defensive strategy? Sort of like if you do get into the place where you're a loser, you start off that way to defend yourself?
You know, I don't want to get into Trump's mind here. I try not to do that. But I do think that what some of my older research has shown is that people are more motivated to engage in political behaviors to protect things that they have that they think they might lose than they are to gain something that they might want that they think they could get. And so in a sense, you know, and I think that part of this is just Trump being Trump, feeling like, you know, he's always put upon. But there's also the sad reality that it's an effective political strategy to say that we're being threatened, to increase anxiety, to make people feel like they're going to lose things that they have. And so even though he won, to say, now we're going to get X, Y, and Z things done is less effective as a motivating strategy to say, we're going to protect these things that now are being attacked.
And that's almost the essence of his rallies, really.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. That's
is to agitate this, like, you don't want to lose this, we don't want to lose this, we're being attacked type of thing.
Exactly.
I'm curious, because Lindsay, when you talked about where we are at with the impeachment inquiry, I want to talk a little bit about the optics and the role it plays in this dynamic, because some suggest that the Trump administration strategy of kind of saying, yes, we did this and it's perfectly fine, seems more effective than the drumbeat of stories that we're seeing coming out of the House inquiry, essentially because what a lot of Republicans are saying is it's behind closed doors. So even though there's like this constant like, hey, here's this testimony that happened today, here's what's happening today, it almost seems like the idea that you can say something that seems like either false or ridiculous, but do it out in public and say yes and it's fine, has bigger weight than what's actually going on, because it can be accused of being behind closed doors.
Right. Well, it's complicated. It's more complicated. It's a lot easier to be like, okay, so that came out. Yeah, I did it. What are you going to do? It's no
Get
big
over
deal.
It.
Get over it.
Right.
So I think that that's a strategy in and of itself to delegitimize it. And I think it piggybacks on what you're saying is to be like, everybody's always picking on us. You know, why are you guys making such a big deal out of this? I think what needs to happen in terms of optics for the Democrats and for the congressional leadership who are on these House committees, I think they need to bring this out into the open. I think that it was a good strategy. I think it was important to them to keep some of this behind closed doors to protect the witnesses. But we're at that point where I think the public needs to see what's going on. They need to see these people actually talking. And I think that will change things dramatically.
I would say, I would add to that, that this everything's happening behind closed doors is also part is conspiratorial, right?
Right, exactly. That's why it seems like it just falls right into this whole dynamic.
Absolutely, it does. And it's a way to delegitimize it. But the Democrats are also gun-shy here because the Mueller testimony was in public and that fell like a lead balloon. And so I think that Nancy Pelosi's strategy here is to sort of shore everything up behind closed doors before presenting it to the public. But the problem is the longer the Democrats seem as not being transparent, the more the Trump administration and his surrogates can say, yeah, we did that. Now they're trying to make something of nothing behind closed doors.
And it almost feels in some ways, I mean, it feels clear to me that some of these like opening statements that are kind of being leaked out there, it's an effort to kind of get it out there so it's not completely behind closed doors. But it almost seems counterproductive because then it's like, see, they're leaking selective things.
Absolutely.
And it even goes back to some of the stuff they put out earlier. Well, they're cherry-picking pieces of these text messages. And that just seems like that seems to be a real concerted strategy to kind of play into these conspiratorial ideas.
Yeah. And it's one of the reasons that conspiracy theories are really hard to debunk and get someone to say, okay, that isn't happening, because any evidence against it is turned around as being evidence for it. So see, Barack Obama released his birth certificate. That just shows how many more people are behind the scenes involved in this conspiracy and working for this, because look how many people had to be involved to fake this thing. So even proof, even the releasing of the opening statements is seen as, well, they're not telling us everything, so they're clearly still hiding something. And it's even more likely that they're hiding something now that they revealed something, which is the irony of the whole thing.
This is all compacted by, and you know, my research area is looking at technology and politics. This is all sort of compacted by these spirals that people get into when they go to Reddit, when they go to other niche sites that propose these kinds of theories. We should do some research together on how these theories are.
So we bring people together on this podcast.
but yes, it just becomes a reinforcing spiral. The more you go into it, the more you hear those terms. QAnon is a great example of this. Just developing like, you know, the number 17 is like, you know, an important number to them. Like, why did that happen? I don't know, but they all know that that's an important number, the letter Q, obviously. And so it's from the outside, we look at it like, I don't understand. That doesn't even make any sense. But from the inside, it's reinforcing, it's self-reinforcing, and it becomes more powerful.
Yeah.
And to kind of build on this, I guess the next place we need to talk about is kind of how to respond. You talked about the difficulty debunking things. And I kind of want to specifically first look at the Biden campaign response to the Hunter Biden piece of this Ukraine story. And whether the media and others saying, you know, as they kind of start the discussion, there's no evidence of any wrongdoing here, but and then going into a discussion of how Biden, you know, should have been more aware of how this might have looked, and you know, how much does that kind of send also a you know, a mixed message that in the process of trying to set the table, debunk things, make clear that this is something that is debunked, or in fact, again, kind of goes back and just reinforces what people think.
This is a really difficult nut to crack in terms of how do you effectively, as a news organization or as a politician or Biden's campaign, come back and counter these false stories. And by one, in order to debunk it, you sort of have to repeat it. And the problem is that repetition of the story itself makes people remember it more. And one of the things that we know is the more people remember something, the easier it is to come to mind, the more believable people think it, the more people believe it. And so just the very act of debunking reinforces and reminds people of the rumor itself. And then I think this, but, you know, Hunter Biden and Joe Biden should have been more careful, does absolutely undermine the debunking instead of flat out saying, no, there was no wrongdoing here. It's clear there was no wrongdoing.
Seem to be the Biden strategy, which is like, we're not talking about this. Like, it's totally wrong. Move on. And also kind of goes to the idea that they kind of went to the media and said, please stop talking about this, because essentially it feels like their argument was like, you guys are just making it worse.
Right.
But then even that makes it look like that the Biden campaign is trying to control the media. And it's amazing how it just becomes like this vicious circle.
Right. Well, and it was really interesting to see in the Democratic debates that no candidate was going to touch that.
Right.
Like, it came up, but everyone's like, I'm not taking it.
I'm not going there. Yep.
This kind of all reminds me, I'm doing a little bit of a history lesson in my National Agenda class this year. We're looking at what it has meant to be a citizen over the course of this country's history. And you're talking about Trump's rallies. We're kind of talking about logic versus emotion, I think. Mm-hmm. And this really reminds me a lot of 19th century politics when you voted, it was about consensus. It was about, okay, vote for me, and everyone tells you, I'm going to vote for you, and then they give you a glass of rum, and everyone celebrates, and it's 100% people voted for me. All right, great. And it's more about the emotion and about the excitement, and it's a party. It's fun. And at the turn of the 20th century, we began to be more like, you know, we should be serious about this. We should look at the facts. We should pay attention to what's really going on. And I feel like this is, again, kind of a battle between those two perspectives about, like, do we want to be good citizens who look at the facts and make decisions logically, or do we want to be the good citizens who are patriotic and care about our country and don't listen to the garbage, just follow our gut?
Well, it kind of almost goes back to that whole idea of, you know, people would say, like, well, I voted for George W. Bush because he's the kind of guy I want to have a beer with.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so they kind of like, I'm going to go with my gut over anything else. And it does seem like it kind of goes... It does seem that there are times where it does kind of go in waves, and we're kind of back to a piece where maybe the emotion part is taking a little bit hold more. Having said all that, is there a sense of what campaigns should not be doing? Are there best practices here that are developing based on what we've learned from Hillary Clinton and her emails and all the things that happened in 2016? Or is it still really just kind of like, all right, we're going to try this and see how that works?
I think it's more the latter. Mm-hmm. We're going to try this and see what works. And different campaigns will handle these things differently. And I also think it matters what the attack is about, and how candidates each individually decide whether they're going to let something slide or whether they're going to combat it directly. I know one of the things that the DNC is doing is they've developed some tools to track when rumors or when false information about a campaign starts to take hold online, whether it be through Twitter, I think is mostly where they're working, but probably also Facebook a little bit as well.
Sure.
And making so they can identify when something is starting to move out of the fringe groups like 4chan or Reddit and into the mainstream, and letting candidates know about that, and then letting the campaigns themselves decide whether to ignore it or to address it. And there's no easy answer here, because again, addressing it makes you seem defensive. And it also reminds people of it, and it amplifies it.
But it goes against maybe the instinct to get ahead of the story.
Right. And then so do you, well, it's in 4chan and Reddit, it may come out, so therefore, maybe we should get ahead of it. But what if it never did come out, and now we've made it come out? And so I think, and I want to emphasize here that this isn't new, right? This isn't just a social media phenomenon. This has been going on for centuries. How do candidates deal with a scandal that they know that's in their closet that may or may not come out? But now we're dealing with not only just scandals that a candidate knows that he or she may have in their closet, but trying to anticipate any old lie that could be made up about a candidate.
And think back to when we all first started getting on Facebook, and you know, we told our students, like, be careful, don't put anything on there that's going to be incriminating. Someone could look it up if you're getting a job. And now they would always argue, like, well, everybody's got Facebook, everybody's got social media, everybody's going to have something in their closet, so it's not going to matter. I wonder if we're in kind of a unique period where it matters right now, but maybe by 2024, it's like, yeah, we're all awful people. We've all done terrible things. Let's get over it and move on. I don't know.
Well, I'm curious, you know, kind of building on this, you know, and you alluded to it earlier, like, how does the media deal with this? What role do they play in making that decision, serving as what they're – have long been considered gatekeepers, and either A, deciding to cover or not cover something, or correct or not correct, or how do you correct it? And it comes in an era where, you know, the media makes its own mistakes, and
Absolutely.
They're probably a little bit more obvious. We saw recently ABC have video that they kind of misrepresented as being from Syria when it was in fact not. So there's already kind of that undercurrent that undermines credibility in an era where people are already calling the media fake news, and now there's kind of this other piece of it as well. I mean, it seems like it's an incredibly complex puzzle.
It is. And also, the other day, the New York Times saying that they misquoted Hillary Clinton as saying that Tulsi Gabbard was a Russian asset when she actually said that the Republicans were grooming her. The mistakes are going to happen like this, right? I mean, the media make mistakes, especially in a breaking story when everyone's trying to get the information out and they're putting stuff out there, and then later they have to correct some things, and that's going to happen. And so those corrections need to be made. Mm-hmm. What we know, though, is that the corrections don't travel through the social media sphere as quickly and as deeply as the
actual story
itself. Mm-hmm. And so what do you do as a media organization, especially when it's your own mistake,
right?
And you're even potentially even more motivated to correct it. I just recently read there's a group at Arizona State. It's their News Co. Lab. Mm-hmm. Dan Gilmore is the director. And they've been doing some experiments with looking at pieces of corrections that media have made, mistakes that the media has made, and their corrections, where they've actually been going through and going onto Twitter and seeing who has been sharing, who has the most likes on the shares of the wrong information, and directly either DMing them or directly tweeting at them specifically to get them to retract to their followers.
Right.
Now, that's an intense,
labor-intensive
piece of work, and I'm not saying that that's the way all media organizations should go to correct errors that happen. But it's an interesting piece to say, okay, if I can't just put it out there and hope that it takes hold, maybe I can directly talk to a couple, you know, social media, I hate the word influencers, but that are the ones who are pushing this and try to get them to correct
it.
Get the ball rolling a bit.
Well, I'm going to do another history lesson here, thinking about the role of media and how that has changed so dramatically. And I think, again, we had this role of newspapers being incredibly partisan, openly partisan.
Absolutely.
And then with the professionalization of the press also around the turn of the 20th century, we see fair and balanced. We see news values and norms coming into play. And I could go on and on about how it's changed over the past 100 and some years. But I think it's that the news media is having sort of an identity crisis, because it's like that on the one hand, they want to be fair and balanced and all that, adhering to those norms. But on the other hand, they realize that these news personalities like Sean Hannity or Rachel Maddow, who can be more emotional and who can be more emphatic and kind of talk about themselves a little bit, bring themselves into it, can actually create a better relationship with the audience than someone who's just telling you just the facts.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So I feel like news organizations could do a better job of creating that relationship. In communication research, we call it a parasocial relationship. It's not always a good thing, but it does help create some connection and some identification with that media source. So I say, you know, just be totally truthful. Yes, we're partisan. We're Fox News. We're partisan. We're MSNBC. We're partisan. We're not trying to be anything else. This is who we are. I think that level of honesty and truthfulness would increase media trust, which as of now is at one of its lowest points. Yeah.
So, I mean, we've talked a lot about the social media aspect of this. What role do the tech companies and the social media platforms play as gatekeepers in all this? Mm-hmm.
So what role do they play, or what role should they play
as
a gatekeeper?
I'll take either answer.
Well, right now, they're not doing much. You know, Mark Zuckerberg is saying, you know, I'm not going to take Trump's fake ad. I'm not going to take his ad down, even though it includes false information, because of free speech. And this is, I was just talking to my students about this yesterday. If the path of the internet had taken a different direction, had not become corporatized, I was telling them there's only one website left that looks anything like the web when it first started, and that's Wikipedia, because it doesn't have advertising. It's crowdsourced. It's the old Wild West of the internet, where we kind of rely on each other to make it a good resource. But everything else has become corporatized. So I said, instead of Facebook deciding whether or not to take that ad down, we could be in an alternate universe where there's some government agency that's in charge of that kind of speech. So I feel like I'm going back in time for every answer here, but
I should have like that like time travel like sound effect for you.
That would be great because you'd be going back to the 90s. That'd be perfect. Wayne's World sound effects.
There you go.
But yeah, I mean, I feel like we have to keep in mind that that corporatization of technology and of the internet has brought us to a pretty dangerous place, I think.
Yes, but I don't think we'd be in any better place if a government agency was deciding what is truth and what isn't truth and what should be on and
Good
what
point.
Shouldn't be on. Mm-hmm. And I don't want...
So who's the decider?
George W. Bush.
Right, there you go. George W. Bush is
See,
the
now
decider.
Now I'm going back in time.
Now you're going back
it.
In time.
Right.
We need that sound effect for you. I think we are mm-hmm. in some respects, right? Facebook is not a news organization. They can't rely on the notion of news values to decide whether, like, for example, CNN recently refusing to air a Trump ad about mm-hmm. about the Biden the lies they were telling about the Hunter Biden and Ukraine because it didn't meet their news standards. Zuckerberg doesn't have any of that with Facebook. It's not that platform. I frankly don't want him deciding what is a lie and what isn't a lie and what should show up and what shouldn't show up. Yes, there are things that we could all absolutely agree is a lie. And I think we could all, and maybe not even all, decide that that shouldn't be there. But we quickly get to the gray area. And I'm concerned about... in any way requiring of a tech company mm-hmm. And the CEO of a tech company or his or her minions deciding what is truth and what isn't. Now, I think it's perfectly reasonable as consumers, and many people are leaving with their feet, a lot of people are leaving Facebook and not joining Facebook, to say, we want you to at least fact check it. And then we can open a whole can of worms about the problems with fact-checking, mm-hmm, which
sure.
we can
right.
talk about if we'd like, or maybe save that for a different day. I have, as Wild Westy as we seem to be again in a different way now, mm-hmm. it worries me to think that Zuckerberg would have has the power to say what I'm going to allow and what I'm not
or
going
Twitter
to allow.
Or Twitter or anybody
Or Twitter
else.
Or anybody, absolutely. Not to pick on just – he just happens to be in the news lately.
Exactly.
He's been out there up front being very specific about
right.
this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, other organizations like – other media companies like Twitter have also not been all that willing to take down tweets that
– Suspend accounts.
Suspend accounts that may be needed to be suspended. And when they do, it becomes politicized.
Right. Well, this is a fascinating conversation. And as you said, we could go on, and we probably will at some other time. But right now, we're going to start to wrap things up with, sure. as we always do, our political quick take, quick hot take, hot quick take, whatever you want to do. Joanne, we'll start with you.
Sure. So my quick take of the day is that Hillary Clinton will not jump into the 2020 Democratic primary for president, but Republicans will continue to push rumors that she's going to do so, because Clinton is a much more effective boogeyman for the Trump campaign to run against and fundraise it on, given the massive hatred that GOP and Republicans in the public and Trumpers have of her. She's a much more effective boogeyman than any of the candidates who are actually running on the Democratic side.
Yeah, and until there actually maybe is one or two kind of candidates that people coalesce around, it's easier to pick somebody and be like, we don't want this to happen.
Somebody who's known, somebody who is very disliked yep. in those circles. It's much easier, and you see it at all his rallies.
Yeah.
It's much easier for Trump to run against Hillary Clinton right now and to raise a ton of money
mm-hmm.
on
than
that.
Anything else.
And keeping that rumor alive enables him to do that.
Lindsay, you're up.
Well, speaking of boogeymen,
and we didn't even plan that.
Well, nice.
Well played. Good segue.
Thank you. Halloween is coming upon us, and you know, instead of thinking about all the crazy things that are happening right now, I've been having some fun thinking about what would be some good, funny political Halloween costumes. So I'll admit, I stole this one from my husband. He came up to me this morning and he said, I think I've got the Halloween costume. A squid hat with money in it. And I was like, what? What are you talking about? And he's like, squid pro quo. Cheesy, yeah. But so hopefully his friends don't hear this and he can still surprise him with his squid pro quo costume. I have seen other ones like impeachment, dressing up as a peach, even the peach emoji, which is very popular right now, and holding perhaps a tin of mints. You could always go as one of Donald Trump's insults, maybe Sleepy Joe if you're in the Delaware state of mind. And then I was thinking, I don't know, Joanne, if you have an idea, but if you could be a conspiracy theory for Halloween, what would it be? Maybe dressing up as a Q, the letter Q?
Q would work, or you think back to think about the Illuminati. Think about dressing up as a pyramid with
the big eye.
Would be a perfect conspiracy theory costume that I just came up off the top of my head. We didn't plan this either.
I imagine there are people out there with even more like elaborate ideas, and I'm sure by the time Halloween gets here, we'll see them.
But I can't wait to see it.
Yes,
we are done on this podcast. Dr. Lindsay Hoffman, UD Center for Political Communication Associate Director and National Agenda Series Director, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Also, Dr. Joanne Miller, Associate Professor in UD's Department of Political Science and International Relations, thank you for the fascinating conversation.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Delaware Public Media News Director Tom Byrne. We will see you again next time on the Direction of Democracy podcast. Thanks for joining us. Thanks for listening to this edition of the Direction Democracy podcast, produced by the University of Delaware Center for Political Communication and Delaware Public Media. For more information on the University of Delaware Center for Political Communication's Direction Democracy National Agenda Series this fall, visit cpc.udel.edu. And a reminder that the next Direction Democracy National Agenda Series event is November 6th with former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie. It starts at 7:30 at UD's Mitchell Hall, and registration is required to attend. Thank you.